You are listening to The Link, an interactive podcast hosted by public policy experts at the U.S. Oncology Network. Your link to the policy that matters most.
All right, welcome back to The Link. We're here in Orlando still on site just after lunch. And today we're going to be joined by Dr. Richard Ingram, Virginia of Shenandoah Oncology. Dr. Ingram, thank you again for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me here. It's been a great meeting. For those in attendance, I'm sure you're enjoying it. And those who can't make it, try to keep track of things that we'll have coming out after the meeting.
No, yeah, definitely. And so tell us a little bit more about your experience so far and how the meeting's been going. And some of your, I think you're speaking on another panel, is that right?
Yeah, so this is a great meeting. You know, for the U.S. Oncology Network, we've always been aligned, and one of the great power of the network is community and spending time together in our own national meeting. But this is a nice transition to other community providers. I think the U.S. Oncology Network physicians that I've run into have really seen a lot of advocacy and other issues go on that they may have been aware of at the federal level and or state level, but I think it's eye-opening to always see it from a different perspective. And certainly the clinical energy and the advocacy energy is quite high. And so I think it's been a great meeting so far, and we're only midway through day one.
Yeah, definitely. I think we've seen a lot of the energy. I'm also joined right now by Allison on our state team and also Lisa from our federal team as well. So what do you think, Allison? How do you think everything's going?
Oh, it's been a whirlwind, but it's so exciting. Every single panel that I've seen has been so interesting. I've learned so much, and all of the physicians from the U.S. Oncology Network that I've seen have done such a good job of really explaining some of the nuances of some of the policies that we've been talking about, and I'm so excited to see some of the other panels that are coming up.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I completely agree. The panels have been really fantastic so far, learned a ton. Also, the networking opportunities have been really great, just catching people in the hall outside of the main exhibit and just, you know, grabbing people here and there and sitting through one of the panels together and sharing commentary and feedback on the panel and what everyone's talking about.
So, Dr. Ingram, what else have you guys been doing in Virginia? Tell me a little bit about some of the stuff. I know you've been working closely with Allison and the state team.
Oh, yeah, no, I appreciate that. No, Allison and her team have been a great source of energy. We have the State Oncology Society, the Virginia Association Hematology Oncology, of which I've been on the board for a long time, currently serve as president. But we've had advocacy work for years, but Allison's team's really helped accelerate and focus a lot of our work, which I greatly appreciate and appreciate on behalf of the patients that will ultimately benefit from the advocacy. You know, there's a lot going on at the state level. I think a lot of docs focus on the federal policy and the bigger picture, which is very appropriate. You know, but state by state, there's a lot of decisions being made that affect patient care, patient access, co-payment, clinical trial participation, you know, all of which we have an interest in. But, you know, currently we've honed in on an issue. You know, in Virginia, you know, there's a unique situation in that individual municipalities have to generate their own tax base and revenue. And there's a business tax, with the acronym is BPOL or BPOL, which had, I think, the best of intentions, but kind of an unintended consequence is it's a tax on gross receipts of a business as opposed to actual profit. It does not factor in expenses, does not factor in actual payments, simply gross receipts. So in a world of chemotherapy in a community practice, our public payers, sometimes our gross receipts, i.e. the cost of the drug, is more than the reimbursement. So we're underwater. So it's in essence a compounded fee on top of already, you know, ASP plus 4.5 with sequestration as opposed to plus 6. So Allison's team picked right up on that, and we've had some successful initial first talks. I'll let Allison kind of tell us some of the civics lessons about us, but it's been a great journey with her.
So I would say that we knew this was going to be an uphill battle to get some flexibility around this issue as soon as we took a look at it. There are roughly 300 counties and municipalities in the state of Virginia, and they each have their own sort of percentage rate. They've got their own flexibility to set their rate for these BPOL taxes, and some of them can be pretty high. And community oncology practices, their BPOL rates are set at the highest possible rate. So initially going in, we thought that we were going to need to ask the state of Virginia for some flexibility just to allow the localities to set a lower rate. And honestly, when we did some digging, we did some analysis, we reached out to the chair of the House Finance Committee in the Virginia legislature, and we realized that that wasn't necessarily the case. We could ask for flexibility to really just get rid of B-poll tax for anti-cancer drugs for patients who are on Medicare, Medicaid, and TRICARE, these government payers, where we are underwater on these drugs already and paying taxes on the reimbursements, not on profits, on reimbursements. Delegate Roxanne Robinson, the chair, she drafted this bill for us. She put it into the legislature, and we knew we would need to quite literally pound the pavement. We would need to fight hard, because the legislature has not done anything on this tax in over 25 years. And the current governor, Glenn Youngkin, when he was elected, he said that his major priority was to reduce taxes in Virginia, but that's really difficult in this current economy. They really can't do much on taxes when people are hurting and the economy is suffering. So we met with every single member of the House Finance Committee, including the delegate that represents Delegate Ingram. Mm-hmm. Oh, sorry, that represents Dr. Ingram. Mm-hmm. You can see that I meet with so many delegates. Mm-hmm. But Dr. Ingram reached out to his delegate, and we had some really genuine discussions about Winchester, Virginia, and the impact that it would have. We looked into all of the finances of all of these municipalities, and we found that for the average community oncology practice location with an infusion site, the impact of these B-poll taxes is over $100,000 a year.
And just out of curiosity, do hospitals pay this tax?
Absolutely not. This tax is only imposed on what is considered a for-profit entity, and there is only one for-profit hospital in the entire state of Virginia. So if these patients were forced to go to a hospital instead of their community practice, which, by the way, many of the other specialties that we talked to, the reason why this is only community oncology that was in this bill was because we asked rheumatology, neurology, urology. They don't take Medicaid for the most part in these practices because they made the choice that they did not want to pay B-poll taxes on these drugs, so they would not take these patients. So then all these patients go to a hospital instead of going to the community site of care.
That's a really incredible point to make. What has the response been from lawmakers to that point? That's it's already happening.
Well, that was the point that made a lot of lawmakers vote in favor of our bill. So it got out of the subcommittee unanimously. It got out of the House Finance Committee. It was the first B-poll tax bill to get out of the House Finance Committee in 25 years. It made it out of the House without an amendment, and then it made it into the Senate Finance Committee, where I think the senators in Virginia are, it was difficult for them to truly feel like they could make waves at this point with a new administration and with everything going on in the economy, which I totally understood. So they made an amendment sort of in the final hour that turned our bill into a study. And I would say that in any other state, studies might not mean that much, but in Virginia, this ended up being incredibly huge. So this study passed through the legislature within a week. And what this study ended up doing is, beginning this summer, the legislature will begin an interim working group that is tasked with analyzing and reviewing current state and local policies that would pose reimbursement and operational challenges for community oncology practices to administer anti-cancer drugs in an office setting to patients whose treatment costs are paid for by Medicaid, Medicare, or TRICARE. So this working group is going to meet periodically throughout the interim, and it will conclude the meeting, their final meeting, on October 1st, 2023. The working group is going to develop a report of findings and recommendations that will submit to the chairs of the following committees in the Virginia General Assembly: the House Committee on Finance, House Committee on Appropriations, House Committee on Health, Welfare, and Institutions, Senate Committee on Finance and Appropriations, and Senate Committee on Education and Health. This report is due November 15th, 2023. So here are the members of this working group. It's going to be overseen by the Virginia Secretary of Health and Human Resources, the Department of Health. There will be a member of the Medical Society of Virginia, which will be a member that will be a community oncologist. It will be a member from the Virginia Association of Hematologists and Oncologists, which we are hoping Dr. Rich Ingram will be considering joining. Will you join?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yes.
And then the Virginia Association of Counties, the Virginia Municipal League, and then, of course, myself and some of our U.S. Oncology Network staff. We will be support staff helping draft this report, and the Department of Medical Services will help draft the report as well. So what this means for us is we are going to get to do a honey-do list for the state of Virginia, saying anything reimbursement-wise, operational-wise, any state and local policies that could impede our ability to treat Medicaid, Medicare, TRICARE patients in the community. We get to ask them to fix it, and we get to ask them to fix it this year. It's pretty great.
It is. It's a great example of common sense lobbying and presenting a narrative about the constituents. And when you talk to these assembly people about the constituents, it resonates. You know, we tried to make the point that this is not on other services we offer because we realize that this is a tax base the municipalities need and there's not a revenue offset. This is simply on these specific payers and specifically not charging us on gross receipts. And in essence, if we shunted these patients out of our practice to a not-for-profit hospital, they'd be zero revenue they'd be receiving. It didn't make that threat, but I think it was understood that this is, you know, would be going away.
That's a great point.
And then the money that we hope to get back from the practices are going to be not reinvested in the doctor's W-2, but into the practice. I mean, it's going to let us retain a social worker. It's going to let us retain a treatment room nurse. It's going to let us retain a nutritionist. It's going to let us actually give care to the community, which is also what we value and bring out and will allow us to keep our doors open as an oncology, especially for these patients with, you know, kind of borderline resources and public health insurance, which was intended to care for our citizens. And at times, as we just heard from Allison, some, you know, some specialties are under no option but to divert the patients. It's not that they're bad people or bad doctors. They just, you know, can't do it. So I just want to make it be known that, you know, this still would pay people on all the other things. We realize the importance of the infrastructure in our communities and the lack of revenue offsets, but it's a common sense approach. And to Allison's point, I think once we got in front of our delegates and just told the story, it really resonated. And I think it's a good example, win, lose, or draw, on how we can proceed ahead with other issues. And realize it's a process. This work in this committee, while it seems long and a stalling block, I don't think it is. I think this will be very productive. As a society member, I was on a compounding legislation, similar task force, and it really yielded fruit. You bring the stakeholders together, you realize you're more like-minded than not. And that's the power of just being a citizen, you know, in the Commonwealth of Virginia or any state in the union. You have a right to talk to your assembly person and make a difference.
And that's a really good point. Just because we didn't get our original BPOL tax repeal language through, that doesn't mean that it doesn't get included as a bullet point on the list of all the other policies we want to talk about.
That's exactly right. And I think if anything, this will just, if this is a win-win, triple win, I should say, for the patients, the providers, and, you know, and for the public good of the revenue, keep the revenue, then this just builds a bridge, a relationship for the next issue. And you just keep, you know, you keep that relationship with your delegate. They understand they're going to remember your name, or they're going to remember their constituent's name. And it means a lot to them to come into their districts and, you know, see Mr. or Mrs. Smith that they know has gotten care in a community center of any type. It gives them a great sense of pride, and it's what they've been elected to do, is care for their constituents.
Yeah. And doing that educational piece and showing them, I think really illustrates, you know, the great work that you guys are doing, that unless they've had a family member that they're close to done it or themselves, they don't really know about it, especially all those other, the other aspects that you talk about, the social workers, the other people that you have at your practice. I think that is something that the network really, we try to shine a light on, because I think that is something, one of the positive aspects and unique aspects to your practice.
Yeah, and I think it's keeping your doors open for all in your community, which has been our practice mantra. I know it's the network's mantra of all the practices. You know, we are community oncology by choice because we live in the community, we work in the community, we're small business in the community. We try to provide a good living for our staff and a sense of pride that they're part of a bigger mission. High retention and recruitment that way. And you know, these are people, I'm not being funny, these are people you see at your kids' soccer games, you see them at church, you see them in the, you see them in the grocery store, you're part of the community. It's not just a medical transaction, but it's being a community oncologist, which I'm very proud of.
Yeah.
Right. I think one conversation that we had in almost every office that I spoke with was, you know, going back to for every site of service on average, when we crunched all the numbers with people, is that roughly each community oncology practice per location is paying about $100,000 a year in BPOL taxes on these drugs that they're underwater on. And that, if there's a workforce shortage of nurses, I mean, that could go directly back into the community and solve multiple problems for paying for more infusion nurses. That could solve so many other problems with access to care for non-reimbursable services. That could be so many solutions in a community oncology practice that has ripple effects for local economies as well. And that is not lost if the alternative is the patient is no longer in that community practice and going to a hospital instead.
Great point. So Dr. Ingram, I know you made a great point about the importance of social workers, and I'm curious, I'd love to hear more about your experience in the oncology care model. Obviously, the enhancing oncology model goes live on July 1, and so I'd love to hear how your practice is looking at that.
Yeah, so for those in the network, they're in the know, but these are acronyms that are appropriate for value-based care models, you know, by CMMI, meaning, you know, quote, Medicare. And the OCM project was extended slightly in time with the pandemic, but in essence was a 5+ year/6-year project of, you know, trying to bend the cost curve and look at the total cost of care of cancer patients, and with the realization that there were perhaps some preventable costs and, you know, enhanced services that you could provide. We had a big commitment to start to provide counseling and social work in our practice independent of the OCM, in that we knew it was an unmet need and an under-resourced specialty in our area. So we were so fortunate to have hired a licensed clinical social worker that has made a huge difference in the counseling portion, distress counseling, for our patients and even family members, which again is a great value add, not just in value add and not just for the program, but for the patient as a whole. We're big believers in our practice of trying to deliver the highest quality care in your community, you know, at the best cost, with the realization that that cost, if you can keep that cost down, it allows the system to stay solvent around the patient, a safety net per se. And patients aren't forced into making decisions about, can I afford my rent or my car payment this week or my medical care? I can stay in my community. I don't have to spend extra money on gas to go to university hospital that I don't have. I don't have to be lost in a kind of foreign land of driving 40, 50 miles away, 6 miles away to university hospital and navigate a difficult campus. I don't have to be lost in that my treatment team's at a faraway place and I have symptoms acutely and I show up in my local emergency room or urgent care, and they're unaware of my team, which is no one's fault. It's just that my team's far away. And so all that ripple effect is huge. Our interest in the EOM model is similar because, you know, I think as a practice, we kind of see the value-based care paradigms, you know, evolving and here to stay. And why not stay ahead of the curve? Why not get the team in place, get them their clinical repetition, similar to a baseball player getting their batting reps in with a program like this that's definable, so we know if the future changes in the commercial space or at the state level, we're prepared and have the infrastructure. And even if it doesn't change, we're providing comprehensive community care that really no one can touch in the way we can.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Can't wait to hear more and see you know, what the first lessons that come out of the enhanced oncology model are.
Yeah, I agree. It's exciting times, and we're anxiously awaiting around the country, and I just work the agreements to come out from CMMI to review, and the go live dates coming up faster than we think in early July.
Yeah, definitely. I know a lot of practices are anxiously waiting for some of that data to put that into perspective.
Absolutely.
So as we wrap up, just a little bit more, bringing it back to COA and the conference, what are you looking to hopefully get out? We have about another maybe half day overall. What are you hoping to get out the next, you know, day, and what are you most looking forward to, and what are some of the takeaways you hope to bring back after this?
Yeah, it's a great point. I try to bring up to a lot of young docs and medium-age docs and old people like myself and the game. I always learn more at a conference of networking and talking to colleagues. I learn a lot from the structured talks. Don't get me wrong, I totally do. But I just, a colleague of mine, we just had a cup of coffee together and we strategized through some EOM questions we both had, and I fantastic exchange emails and phone numbers. We'll keep in touch. So you can really network and find colleagues here like no other. If you're here and you're focused and you're concentrated in your efforts, this is a robust, you know, there's near 2,000 people here who are like-minded, all of which want to share ideas. It's another part of being a community oncologist. As was said earlier in one of the talks, we're never really in competition with each other, meaning if my practice does well in Winchester, Virginia, and has a solution, some practice in Maine, New Mexico, Vermont's going to do well, because I'm happy to share the secret sauce and help a patient. So I'm looking forward to more networking. There's some great individual granular talks coming up on both policy and some procedural issues. There's a great talk coming up on optimization and reducing of burnout with your staff, which I think is very relevant and could bring back to my team. And I'm looking forward to a little bit of socialization. I have to admit, the pandemic has pent us up for the right reason. It was all very appropriate, and it was the right thing to do. But I think there's a lot of pent-up professional interactions that have been deferred and delayed that we'll see here in the conference. And so really looking forward. And what I'm really looking forward to is flying home on Friday, because my youngest just got home from college for spring break. And so that is what I'm really looking forward to.
Awesome. Yeah.
Family time.
I keep forgetting that we're in March and it's spring break time. Yeah. Big time here.
Yeah. I'm looking to cuddle up on the couch, watch some Hulu Bob's Burgers with her, and maybe drift off to sleep with some popcorn.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ingram. We really appreciate your time and sticking with us. We'll be back with you all later this afternoon with some more guests.
That's great. I really want to thank Lisa and Allison. And in all seriousness, just get involved. The great team. This is an example of what can be done. And it's an obvious pitch, but it's generally said that a lot of affection for them and the work they do and how many patients they have helped. It means a lot to us in the trenches. So thank you.
Appreciate that. Yeah, thanks.
Of course. Mm-hmm. And if there are any listeners out there who are living in Virginia and are working in the community oncology and community down there, I will be at the VAHO Spring Forum. Please join us there. We will be talking more about this on May 11th through 13th.
Awesome. Well, hopefully we'll see some of y'all there, and we'll speak to y'all again soon.
Thank you for listening to the Link Podcast, your link to the legislature. For more information on healthcare policy and the U.S. Oncology Network, visit www.legislink.com.